Aaron, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. Alec Barron on behalf of the plaintiff appellants, and with the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honors. As the Supreme Court made clear in Tibble versus Edison, ERISA's duty of prudence requires 401k plan fiduciaries to continually monitor the investments in a plan and remove imprudent ones. This court explained in SWEDA that the ongoing investment monitoring obligation includes giving appropriate consideration to those facts and circumstances that the fiduciary knows or should know are relevant to the particular investment involved and account for changed circumstances. The Quest fiduciaries failed this duty when they retained a series of investments that violated the very evaluative criteria they chose for the plan and attempted to cover up their malfeasance by removing those exact criteria from the policy itself after this lawsuit was filed. The district court erred by reducing ERISA's duty of prudence to a checklist, regardless of facts from which a jury clearly could draw an inference of imprudence. This error is made plain by focusing on a few of these factual areas. First, the plan's investment policy statement, or IPS, established specific metrics and time horizons pursuant to which the plan's investment should be reviewed, failure of which would render an investment eligible for removal from the plan. The Freedom Funds and Invesco Fund, those are the challenge funds here, failed these metrics for years at a time. Yet the investment committee did not investigate the causes or contemporaneously articulate why retention of those investments was appropriate.
All right, well, let's start. You say these funds underperform, but as to what and compared to what, it seemed like you were trying to compare these actively managed funds with passively managed funds. And of course, there's an argument in favor of passive investing, but can you really say that the whole approach or strategy, are we going to rule that basically funds have to have only passively managed ones because they have lower transaction costs? I mean, that would seem to be a market innovation in the case law. So those can't be the right comparators, can they?
We agree with that proposition, Your Honor. Here, there are a number of comparisons that are part of the record that we believe support denial of summary judgment. First,
all right, so you are not, you are dropping the initial comparison with passively managed funds then?
That we believe that's a relevant comparison, but not wholly dispositive in the sense that we're not advocating for a rule that these plans must have passively managed investment right, because they're cheaper.
All right. The next problem I have with your case, anytime you hear an ad for investments, you always have the disclaimer, past performance is not a guarantee of future performance, right? We all know that. There's the danger that whenever a stock drops, like is the fiduciary going to be sued, and that's a hindsight problem, because by definition, you know, you could, with hindsight, you can show something did worse than something else. But you're not suggesting that we can just use hindsight and say there were a few underperformance here, can you? I mean, how could they necessarily be charged with knowing that ex ante?
Well, this is not a hindsight comparison from our perspective, Your Honor. The investment benchmarking exercise that we undergo here relates specifically to the investment policy that the fiduciaries chose. That policy provided, quote, in determining whether to place a fund on watch or terminate it, the investment committee will consider all relevant factors, including, and this is a direct quote, a fund that underperforms the performance standards set forth in this policy over the most recent 3-year period. That's the analytical framework that we use here. The Quest fiduciaries in this case chose as their investment policy that this retrospective rolling 3-year period was the relevant analytical framework in order to review investments. In addition to that, Mercer, the plan's investment consultant, said in real time to the committee as early as 2014 that it believed there were better target date fund offerings in the Fidelity Freedom Funds. This all makes up a mix of information that's not simply looking at hindsight performance and trying to bootstrap a claim that because the investments didn't ultimately perform better in the future, there's a breach of fiduciary duty. In this case, the information available to the fiduciaries at the time, both under their investment policy statement, which prescribed a certain analytical framework, as well as what
it didn't prescribe, did it? It was permissive. It wasn't mandatory. It didn't prescribe really anything.
Well, we agree that there's a degree of permissive language built in, but that framework, from our perspective, does give rise to a tribal issue of fact as to whether that language, that analytical framework, is relevant in evaluating the fiduciary's conduct. Of course, it's not a quick trigger. It's not a prescriptive. It's not written in a prescriptive way.
Right. I worry that you're not separating out two steps. There's the step of whether the process was prudent, and then, if we even get there, whether the funds themselves were objectively prudent. And you seem to be focusing just on step two, right? So first of all, do you agree that you have to satisfy both steps?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, let's take step two that you're on now, but I do want to get back to step one. You're not saying that just because there are arguably better funds or just because Mercer thought that there were better options means that picking these, allowing these options on a menu of options was imprudent, are you?
Well, our contention here is that on the basis of information that was being provided by Mercer, that there were better offerings in this space, on the basis of failures of frameworks established by the fiduciaries themselves, that more investigation is required. That's what this court's decision in Unisys says, that you can't simply passively take information that might give rise to concerns with the fund and call it a day. Here, the fiduciaries should have been absorbing information from their advisor under the framework that they chose for themselves. There's also in the record—
How do you address the, I think the district court hit this and so did your friend. The meeting minutes reflect at least a measure of diligence. Like, what is your response to that?
The meeting minutes, typically when they involve investment evaluation, say something to the effect of the committee evaluated the performance of all funds in the plan. It doesn't reflect deliberation over the concerns raised by the investment advisor in real time. But isn't
that more a dispute about their note-taking practices or the formatting of their minutes than, you know, legal sufficiency of a process or legal sufficiency of the prudence of the investments?
From a process perspective, we believe that doesn't extinguish any issue of fact as to whether, relative to these specific investments, which the information—
But it seems like you're saying there was no deliberation and the minutes support an inference that there was. Is there a dispute about the accuracy of the minutes? Is there some evidence in the record that what the minutes say didn't actually happen?
But we don't believe it's appropriate to go from the boilerplate statement, all investments in the plan were reviewed, to the conclusion that the fiduciaries actually investigated the specific
funds.
They
did more than that, though. They met with Fidelity.
They met with Fidelity, which was also their record keeper, about general issues concerning the plan at the beginning of the class period. There's no evidence in the record that they actually raised questions about the performance issues that were brought to their attention, about the negative press, both financial and popular press, about these funds, to actually understand why these concerns existed, whether they would be corrected in the future, sufficient to give the fiduciaries any justifiable belief that they would actually improve their performance. And their investment advisor raised concerns in 2014, mentioning concerns about the quality of underlying funds. That's Appendix 7069. In 2016, noting that the underlying funds remain an area of concern as few are highly rated. That's at Appendix 3062. In 2020, observing, and this is in an email to a committee member, that the inconsistent performance has been an ongoing problem. That's Appendix 6853.
Okay, so, you know, Mercer does not recommend removing the funds. And I worry that your test is put these funds in a vise, which is, if you go and make minutes and you dare put down in the minutes concerns about funds, there's going to be a gotcha, and this is going to be used to sue them later. They can't speak frankly investigating without then going and cutting the funds. So they're going to need to paper the file and say, everything is wonderful. Shouldn't we, rather than punish them, reward them for going through a process, expressing concerns, doing some work, even if they ultimately decide, like, look, this is not serious enough to terminate? I think you're drawing very different inferences from that than your friends on the other side would.
But I think the drawing of different inferences kind of highlights the issue. It's a summary judgment. This is a complaint which the district court found was sufficient to state a claim. We've got evidence of these issues being brought to the committee's attention, both under the framework they chose from their advisor and third-party sources. And we're talking about inferences that might be drawn from all of that evidence in order to conclude as a matter of law, one way or another, that the process was prudent. You know, I've been counsel in a number of other cases involving the Fidelity Freedom Funds, and in every single one to go to summary judgment on a similar record has proceeded to trial. You know, I've tried
but
these cases.
I worry the best you can say is there are funds that have better prospects. Are we going to, tell us which of these cases have gone ahead and why it is that we should say whenever you can point to some funds with better prospects that it has to go to trial. I mean, when we look at these, the Freedom Funds are ranked at the median by the end of 2014. Are we going to say that any fund that's at the median is not good enough to offer? That, you know, it seems like the standard you're setting up is really an untenable one for fiduciaries.
Well, Your Honor, I would just submit that this is not a matter of counsel picking better funds or the plaintiffs in the case picking better funds and then holding up the plans and the investment to those as benchmarks. We're talking here about the specific information available to the fiduciaries, the benchmarks prescribed under their investment policy statement.
Okay, let's talk about what's available to fiduciaries. Invesco follows a conservative allocation, all right? Is it imprudent to offer conservative investment options? Does the fact that, okay, they had a lower upside on this fund, are you going to tag them with imprudence? Because during a bull market, that means you're going to make less money.
Well, Invesco, from our perspective, the performance was only one of several indicia of imprudence. Invesco lost half of its assets under management in this period. The investment policy statement from the fiduciaries indicated that losing assets under management.
The outflows argument that you're making?
Yes.
Can you just be real precise for me about, when you use that term in the briefs, what you mean by outflows?
We mean that other investors are taking their money out of that investment fund. The investment policy statement indicated that reductions in capital under management in the funds in the plan would be a reason for review and potentially removal from the plan. So this is, over time, investors actually exiting those funds.
All right. My concern is that your argument appears to be entirely a step two argument. This one of the main cases you rely on. Columbia conceded prudent process at summary judgment. Omnicom, the fiduciaries, had no process. Maybe you have an answer now. If you don't, then sit down and be prepared to come back at rebuttal about why, if we take step one seriously, you get past step one and what in the case law says that.
Well, Your Honor, Omnicom is a good example on point here. Mercer, the same investment advisor here, was the investment advisor to the Omnicom plan. Omnicom had a committee staffed by executives with similar backgrounds. They also met quarterly. In fact, the process in Omnicom is remarkably similar to the process here. The shortcomings in Omnicom highlighted tribal issues around the actual process, whether the fiduciaries digested the information from Mercer in that case, and then actually did the investigation to come up with the justification for retaining those funds that was cogent, that was recorded at the time that they could articulate. Here, we have a similar factual matrix regarding the committee structure. We have the same investment advisor. And here we have the additional facts of actually removing the same criteria that they chose for themselves from the IPS after the lawsuit was filed to basically strip their own investment policy of any evaluative framework. Those same criteria that were violated during the class period are no longer in the investment policy statement. That's a permissive IPS.
The committee did more. It met with Fidelity. It didn't meet Fidelity just about record keeping. It met with Fidelity to discuss the glide path. It commissioned Mercer to investigate. So I think this case is distinguishable from those cases.
I think this, looking at the rubric set up by Unisys, for instance, the Third Circuit's case, concerning an investment monitoring process and whether a process that's on the bare bones side is sufficient for prudence as a matter of law. In that case, there was also meetings on a quarterly basis, meeting minutes, an advisor. The Third Circuit has said in the past that is not enough. In this case, those meetings with Fidelity did not result in any analysis and any record here about why the fiduciaries had a justification to retain these plans. That's, from our perspective, we would submit not why they met with Fidelity to talk about these issues that were brought to their attention that they would have known about if they had taken a look.
But isn't it, in this summary judgment motion, isn't it your burden to establish the process was deficient?
I think it's our burden to establish that as a matter of
tribal
fact. There are tribal issues about that.
And so if the record that we have is that these meetings took place and there is at least some inference available of, that they reflect diligence, isn't it incumbent on you to come up with evidence suggesting that supporting a different inference? If it's your element.
We agree with that, and we think that's present here.
Well, you know, I brought up the minutes, and you're bringing up the Fidelity meetings. What's in the record for us to draw an inference that something other than what it looks like happened at those meetings?
We have, every 2 years or so during the class period, very specific concerns being brought to the committee's attention regarding the Fidelity Freedom Funds. We have failures of the evaluative criteria for both the Fidelity Funds and the Invesco Funds. We have the capital flight. In the case of Fidelity, and our fiduciary process expert raised this, and by the way, the expert evidence here was unchallenged, so there is a process expert that identified deficiencies with the process, documentation, governance, and implementation that was admissible at summary judgment, and we think not meaningfully dealt with in the decision, all of which support an inference and could support a conclusion by a fact finder that there were issues with the process here, that those concerns were not assuaged in real time, and that there was justification to retain these funds. And we think that's the process inquiry here, not just ticking the boxes of a process framework that for multi-billion dollar plans is very common.
All right. Thank you. We'll get you back on rebuttal. Ms. Hill, take a moment whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Melissa Hill for the Quest Diagnostics Appellees. May it please the Court. I think what we've heard from appellants this morning is that this case essentially hinges on their claim that because the challenged funds underperformed for a short period of time over short-term performance metrics, and because at some point there may have been better options in the market, the fiduciaries both violated their duty of prudence to engage in a prudent process, and also the funds were not objectively prudent to satisfy the second prong of ERISA's prudence analysis. I'd submit that this issue was recently addressed by a panel of this court in the Cho versus Prudential case just earlier this month, where the Cho court evaluated essentially many of the same facts that we have present here. So engaging a consultant to evaluate the investments, meeting on a quarterly basis, receiving annual fiduciary training, employing a watch list, meeting with fund managers, and evaluating, doing the additional investigation. And the Cho court, the panel, described those different facts as the hallmarks of a fiduciary process, hallmarks of a prudent process. That's what plaintiffs today are calling a checklist, an inappropriate checklist, but what a panel of this circuit has called the hallmarks of a prudent process. And I would submit, Your Honors, that the Quest Diagnostics fiduciaries did more than just satisfy the hallmarks of the fiduciary process. They engaged in the additional investigation that we heard from plaintiffs today would be necessary to satisfy that process. They, as I think Judge Bibas pointed out in questioning my colleague, they met with Fidelity, not just as its record keeper. They met with Fidelity, and the district court, Judge Niels, laid that out in detail and cites to the facts in the record and the reports that were generated in advance of and discussed during each of those meetings with Fidelity. They met with Fidelity to talk about their management strategy. They met with Fidelity to talk about the glide path analysis, which is exactly that, the asset allocation strategy, to understand what their glide path analysis was. They met with Fidelity and asked Mercer to discuss how the actively managed Freedom Funds were performing against alternative options, both actively managed and passively managed. They, at some point, conducted a targeted search of potential alternatives to see whether they wanted to switch from active management to passive management, and concluded that it was not appropriate, and not appropriate for the plan at that time. And that throughout the class period continued to, in the words of the district court, scrutinize the Freedom Funds. At some point, Fidelity recommended placing those funds on watch at the height of the COVID pandemic when the market was fluctuating. And that's what the committee did, and they continued to scrutinize the funds throughout that period. Similarly with the Invesco Fund, which is an actively managed fund that is a conservative strategy expected to underperform in a bull market. And that's precisely what it did, and Mercer continued to rate it as an A rating. Nonetheless, the committee had to meet with Mercer.
Let's talk about some other steps. So Unisys, fiduciaries are supposed to review data from the consultant, assess its significance, supplement it where needed. But did the committee actually do that between 2013 and 2015?
Your Honor, I would submit absolutely. And their 2013 is before the class period, but there are quarterly reports through for every quarter of the class period showing that the committee was meeting with Mercer and was evaluating all of these performance metrics, the evaluative criteria that Plaintiff was discussing. Those are all reported on by Mercer, and the reports, even from that very beginning period of the class period, were robust. And that additional scrutiny that was warranted that kicked off as the class period progressed was just above and beyond those discussions and meetings that were occurring already. And certainly I would submit that the evidence suggests that across the class period, the fiduciaries were engaged in the process in a way that is, I think, not evident in the Unisys decision. So Your Honor mentions Unisys that denied summary judgment, found an issue of fact as to whether or not there was a prudent process and whether the fiduciaries there engaged in a prudent process to evaluate the guaranteed investment contracts that were alleged to be the imprudent investment in that case. And what the Third Circuit there looks to, all of the record testimony, conflicting record testimony between the fiduciaries, the consultants, and the experts, all saying kind of different things about what was reviewed, who was looking at what, the one of the principal fiduciaries charged with evaluating the propriety of the guaranteed investment contract said, I think in his deposition, what I believe is quoted in the Third Circuit's opinion, I don't remember if I was involved with that. I don't know exactly what I looked at. I don't know what metrics I looked at. And so those were some of the distinguishing factors that made that process in Unisys raise a material issue of fact as to whether there was a prudent process.
I'd like to stick with Unisys, but talk about the expert reasoning there. There's a back and forth in the briefs about the expert Driscoll and the process opinions. And so Unisys is talking about an expert, Gottheimer, I'll say it, quoting, based on his interpretation of the deposition testimony and exhibits he reviewed, is itself some evidence of Unisys imprudence, capable of defeating Unisys' motion for summary judgment. And that language, you know, as I read that opinion, you know, it lands pretty hard in this case. And I want to give you a chance to address it and why not controlling here.
Sure, Lee. And thank you, Your Honor, for the question. I think one of the primary differences between the Unisys expert opinions that were at issue and what we have here is the question of whether the expert opinions were supported by the record evidence. So here we have a record of undisputed facts that are before the district court. And they again, outline these hallmarks of the prudent process. They said the fiduciaries did this, this, and this. And then the plaintiff's expert Driscoll comes in and says, a prudent fiduciary would have done something different, would have removed the funds sooner. She also makes some observations that the district court then finds are just unsupported factually by the record. So, for example, that the committee or the fiduciaries didn't discuss this.
Wouldn't it be your job to draw that out on cross at a trial of this expert?
Your Honor, it's not an opinion that needs to... the court doesn't need to determine whether to credit the opinion. It's not if the opinion is not supported by facts. So Rule 56 would say that the district court is not required. Rule 56 actually requires the evaluation of whether evidence is sufficient, and one of those evaluative steps is to say, what do the facts say? And if there is expert testimony, the court is not required to credit it at a Rule 56 stage if it's not supported by the factual record.
Well, so here a lot of the experts report relied on the failure to follow the IPS, which I get it, it's not mandatory, but why wouldn't that be a material fact for a jury to weigh, failure to follow his own investment policy statement? And then second question, can you address the changes made to the IPS after the litigation?
Sure, absolutely, Your Honor. So as to the first question, as to whether it's a question of fact for the fact finder to weigh, to determine whether the IPS was violated. The IPS is a written document, and it's well within the district court's purview to evaluate what it says and what it requires. There's no argument from the plaintiffs here that it was ambiguous. There's no argument that there's competing interpretations among the committee members or that the committee members didn't understand what it meant.
They're saying they just didn't follow it. Not that it's ambiguous, but it's clear and you didn't follow it.
Right. And I think that makes it very, very easily within the court's purview to say, just like reading a contract, it's a written document. It either requires these steps or it doesn't require the steps. And I think Judge Neils appropriately concluded that...
I'm not talking about whether it's required. Let's stipulate they're not required. They're just advisory.
Okay.
And the committee didn't follow that policy advice. Why isn't that a matter for the jury to weigh?
I think the question of whether a fiduciary engaged in a prudent process is a question of law that Judge Neils appropriately reached based on an undisputed factual record. The factual record says the fiduciaries took all these different steps that are laid out in detail, similar to the steps that were taken by Prudential in the Cho case, by Ivonic in the Silva case, by Braun in the Nunez case. And to say, based on all those undisputed facts, I conclude, as a matter of law, that the fiduciaries engaged in a prudent process. And the question of whether the IPS should have guided a fiduciary to a different conclusion, I would submit two things. One, doesn't raise an issue of material fact that would survive summary judgment. But second, then, it is not the law, again, not a question of fact for the fact finder, but it's not the law to say that because there is another preferable approach, the approach that the fiduciaries took was a breach. And in fact, the Supreme Court has recognized in the Hughes versus Northwestern case that the courts must give consideration to the range of reasonable judgments that a fiduciary make, and recognizing the difficult trade-offs that a fiduciary has to make when engaging in that decision-making. So just because the IPS might have advised them that there was another permissible, also prudent course, and perhaps Ms. Driscoll thinks that that would be her preference, there is no evidence in the record that that's what all fiduciaries would have done or that's what a real fiduciary would have done. She just thinks that that's the preferred course based on her reading of the IPS.
The argument would be, this is what the committee itself says is its preferred course, but it deviated from that course.
Well, I think to get to that point, you have to, the court has to first look at what the IPS says and conclude that it does actually say that it should do that. And I would submit that Judge Neils was correct to find that it doesn't require that. Either the earlier version or the later version, the red line version of the IPS that the plaintiffs are making a lot about is certainly in the appellate record and reviewable. I would point the court to the one red line change that they're focused on at Appendix 5808, where it's a 15-page document of all sorts of guidance and criteria that mentions in several places the language that the district court relied on in terms of looking at a whole host of factors, evaluating it over a long period of time, allowing a fund to be evaluated over a full market cycle. All of those things the district court, I think, appropriately found did not amount to a requirement that the funds be removed after short periods of performance on a three-year look-back period. The language that they're focused on says it's just a clause in a sentence where it says to be evaluated over at least a three-year period to provide fund management sufficient time to execute its strategy over a full market cycle, which means you have to leave the investment in the plan for 3 years, not that you just look back on a three-year performance period. And then it says, depending on market conditions, the committee may decide that a longer period is warranted. And language that was removed that the plaintiffs would read as so telling of some nefarious intent is just that, however, a three-year period is generally sufficient for evaluating performance. That's what came out. And you can even see in the record the red line comments between the committee and the investment advisor that says, is this necessary? Is this duplicative? And elsewhere in the document, it reiterates that guidance to review investments over a long period of time. So we would submit the argument as to the changes to the IPS in 2021 is simply a red herring. And I would just note to the extent, and unless the court has further questions, that there are independent grounds on which the court can affirm, including the objective prudence of the investment, which I know we've heard a lot about short-term performance today and what that means as to the prudence of the process. I agree with Judge Bibas that I think at some points in plaintiff's presentation, it seems to conflate the process with the objective prudence argument, but Common Spirit is very clear on this point, the Sixth Circuit case, Smith versus Common Spirit. Mr. Barron mentioned that that all of the Freedom Fund cases he's involved in have gone to trial. I may have misheard that, but to the extent that's what he mentioned, the Smith versus Spirit case was another Freedom Fund case brought by Mr. Barron's firm, and the Sixth Circuit found on a motion to dismiss that the allegations plaintiffs were making there, again only at the pleading stage, were insufficient to state a claim of imprudence as to the Freedom Funds. Looked at exactly the things plaintiffs are raising here, including the short-term performance, including the outflows and the changes in investment, investor strategy that the plaintiffs are pointing to here as both suggesting an imprudent process and suggesting objective imprudence. The Sixth Circuit found, as a matter of law, before discovery even happened, that insufficient to state a claim as to these Freedom Funds. So I would submit that to the extent there's focus on the short-term performance as being evident of an objectively imprudent investment or an imprudent process, the Sixth Circuit has addressed that in an instructive way.
Thank you, Ms. Hill.
Thank you.
Mr. Barron, I believe you reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I'll try to be brief, recognizing I went a little bit over time in my opening segment, but just taking my friend's arguments in turn, first on the Cho versus Prudential case, I think it's important to highlight, first, it's a non-precedential opinion. There was no evidence reviewed regarding IPS failures, as is the case here. And very notably, that decision did not review any expert evidence going to an imprudent process or specific process deficiencies. Also at issue here, we addressed that more in a letter that we filed yesterday. But I think that's relevant to note. I also just want to clear up, there was some suggestion, I think, in my friend's argument, the pre-class period evidence, the 2013 and some of the 2014 evidence, can't be considered. The statute of limitations in ERISA is 6 years, and so that's the recovery period here, but that is not the period, a limiting period for purposes of considering evidence. And this court in Mader versus Wesco last year, I believe, decided that issue in our favor, that you can consider evidence from pre-class period conduct in assessing prudence in the context of an ERISA statute of limitations. There's some suggestion that the district court could simply set aside our expert evidence on the basis that none of it was material. And what I heard from my friend's argument is that's because the expert evidence was not supported by the factual record. That's the stuff of a Daubert challenge, Your Honors. That was not made here. This is admissible evidence, and it's opinion that specific process deficiencies existed here, which prevented the fiduciaries from identifying issues with these investments. And if not made by way of a Daubert challenge, I think, as Judge Bove noted, that's certainly fair for cross-examination at trial, but it's not a basis.
I just worry that sets up a rule, and I'm not referring to your expert or your case, but the kind of argument you're making right now leads to a situation where if you have enough money to pay for an expert who's willing to say what you need said and be untethered from the record, that's a trial case. And I think this is a close issue in terms of what Unisys says and how it applies to this case, but there's problems on both sides there. And I'm not sure if you have a limiting principle on this.
Well, I think there are procedural mechanisms directed at that. I think the rules of evidence in Daubert would prevent expert evidence that's completely untethered from a record.
Talking rules of evidence and we're talking Daubert, usually we're getting pretty close to talking trials, not always, but that what I'm talking about is at the Rule 56 stage, are there limiting principles on the concept of a plaintiff comes up with an expert to say to support the plaintiff in a way that's not connected to the record? I'm not sure that Rule 56 prevents the district court from screening that out if that's all there is.
Sure, I guess our submission on that point would simply be that a challenge could be brought in connection with a summary judgment motion if expert evidence was untethered, such that we don't think it's a fair answer to simply set it aside.
Now, Ms. Hill cited Cho. That was a non-precedential opinion, true, but we affirmed a summary judgment there. There was an expert report was inconsistent with the record. This court, footnote 10, said it was. So an expert doesn't automatically get you past summary judgment. I mean, granted, it's not precedent, but there seems to be sense that you can't just hire an expert and automatically get to summary judgment. So what specifically does the expert need to say, and how much does there need to be in the record to support the expert?
Well, I think this comes back to the theory of the case in Cho. The theory was not premised on violations of an IPS or investment standards that the fiduciaries chose for themselves. And in Cho, the facts included that the fiduciaries met on a biweekly basis with the investment advisor, that there was an in-house benefits team that dealt with these issues all the time. And so I think the factual record in Cho is distinguishable, but I also think the nature of the breach alleged in Cho is sufficiently different that it explains that difference. And you know, we would note that it's fairly well established that once a fiduciary adopts an investment policy statement, failure to comply with it actually gives rise to a potential breach under ERISA. That's the California Iron Workers and Grace Capital cases. And multiple courts have recognized that a genuine dispute as to whether defendants complied with an IPS precludes summary judgment.
Would you say the theory of this case is the failure to follow the IPS?
I think that's a central theory of this case, Your Honor.
Can a committee ever deviate from its IPS and avoid a jury trial?
I think if there, and our expert goes into this, I think if there's a documented reason, if there's analysis done, and there's recognition that despite IPS violations, there is a justification for retaining a fund. And I do want to point out here, my friend noted one page of the IPS that was altered in 2021, but did not point out three other pages that contain critical evaluative criteria relevant to this case.
You want to cite those?
Sure. That's Appendix 5805 to 5806. All of the evaluative criteria, metrics, and time horizons were deleted from the IPS. And then Appendix 5809 contains the actual removal framework that we cite here. Specifically, in determining whether to place a watch or terminate, the investment committee will consider all relevant factors, including a fund that underperforms the performance standards set forth in this policy over the most recent three-year period and others. I just wanted to note for the record that those were also removed, and my friend on the other side didn't touch on those. And then, if I may, just the last point on these other bases for affirmance, we also have expert testimony on those on those areas, and we would submit that since the district court didn't adjudicate any of the Daubert motions, evaluate any of the evidence on those areas, we think that would be for the district court to decide in the first instance. We think the record does also support reversal on those bases, or would support denial of summary judgment on those bases. But you know, we think that the evidence, especially expert evidence, should be dealt with by the district court in the first instance. And then finally, on common spirit, I didn't mean to suggest that every Freedom Funds case ever filed went to trial. Those that were adjudicated on summary judgment all went to trial, and common spirit was the one outlier out of 10 Freedom Funds cases that I'm aware of that was dismissed. All of the others proceeded past the motion to dismiss.
All right, so since you're making these representations, we don't have them, we don't have the names of them, but you know, the juries reject all of these?
One has been actually tried to a decision, and the decision was in the defendant's favor in that case based on the litany of evidence presented at trial, testimony, experts, and the like.
Right, so basically you get past summary judgment and then you get a settlement. What you're saying.
In several of the cases, and in one that was tried, right. The plaintiffs didn't prevail.
Okay. Well, we thank both parties for their excellent briefing and argument. We'll take the matter under advisement. We ask the parties to cooperate in preparing a transcript and to split the cost of it. We'll go off the record briefly. We'd like to thank both counsel for coming today, and we'll greet you over at sidebar.